It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 12 years after the B5 premiere. The Babylon podcast was a dream given form, its goal to discuss Babylon 5 episodes, arcs, and implications, to interview the cast and crew about their experiences and memories. It's a home away from home for fanboys, geek girls, and lurkers. It can be a silly place, but it's our last best hope for B5 fans. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2006. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm still Tim Callender.
Hey there, and I'm still Jeffrey Willis. Today, calling from Studio City, just outside CBS Studios in Studio City, California.
Wow, what are you doing there, Jeff?
I'm a busy guy, finger on the pulse of the television community. What can I tell you, man? I'm actually outside. This is probably good for you, Tim. I'm right outside the studios for That 70s Show, and I just know that's so you.
You know, it's actually funny. My teenage son, he's 15. The other night, he comes to me. He said he watched I Love the 80s on VH1, and he's telling me about all these things that happened in the 80s, and I'm looking at him like going, I lived through it all. I really don't need to hear anymore.
Yeah, let's give up on the past and move into the future.
Exactly.
What do we got on the slate for tonight?
Well, you have a surprise for us, I guess. Well, actually, it's not a surprise this week.
No.
It's not a surprise. I thought it best to give you a little heads up so you could do your homework. I know how you like that.
Thank you very much.
A little homework. I have a question to ask our guest. I'm curious to see how he fields it.
Well, should we get him on the phone then?
Yep, let's do it.
Yeah.
Hello.
Skip Robinson.
This is me.
Skip, it's Jeffrey Willard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jeffrey.
Why is that?
Why is that? Anytime I get to talk to a good buddy like you, it's always good.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Skip, I'd like you to meet our co-host on the Babylon podcast, Tim Callender and Summer Brooks. Say hi to Skip.
Hi, Skip.
Hi. How's everyone doing?
We might have lost Summer. We're doing a connection with four different people from five different places.
Wow.
I'm here.
Okay, great. Well, okay, good. Now we're all back here. So Skip was one of the editors for Babylon 5, which is an incredibly important and underappreciated role in any visual art, as far as I'm concerned.
Hear, hear.
Wait a minute, Tim. I know you're dying to ask Skip some questions.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to make sure I expressed specifically about Skip, since the days of Babylon 5, Skip and I have not been able to see each other as much as we would like to. But in the occasions when we have been able to talk or to see each other, it is so indicative of the way the Babylon 5 universe worked for us there. We just bond right away. We pick up right where we left off. It's as if no time ever passed. Do you agree,
Skip? It's a family. It sure is.
You know,
we were on that show for how many years? Five years.
Yeah, 500 years. I think.
Yeah, 500. 500 seems like 500 at times, but it was a long time.
Well, Skip, how did you get to? Go ahead, Tim.
I think I'm going to ask the same question you were, Jeffrey. I was going to ask Skip how he became part of the Babylon 5 family.
Oh, how did I become? Well, let me go into the Wayback Machine. let's see. I was asked by John Copeland. They had done the Wild West, and I was asked to do that show, and I was doing another show called Renegade. And then Babylon 5 came up, and Susie Sternlight mentioned my name, and they called me in, and that was about it. So I got the job through John Copeland.
Now, I wanted to ask you about Renegade. I did a little research, and thank God for the Internet Movie Database. And it is listed that you worked on a short-lived show called Renegade about a police officer who is wrongly accused of murder. And
correct.
The three reviews that were posted there indicated that it was probably the worst waste of space on television. Now, as an editor, I know you're going to approach a job professionally, but did you sit there thinking, working on this, oh my God, how awful is this?
No, I actually really did enjoy the show Renegade. I mean, the premise was kind of weird, but since I'm a martial artist and Lorenzo Lamas was a martial artist, there was that aspect of the show that I really liked. And, of course, it came from Cannell, so Cannell did all the, cop detective shows, which are sort of in the same genre. But, I really try to, whenever you're an editor, it's really important that you really don't think that way, that you try to make each project the best you can. And if you walk in with the attitude and say, this stuff is crap and that's all it's going to be, then, not only is your reputation going to suffer, but the show will also suffer. So, you have to try to make the best out of every situation. I mean, I've worked on worse shows, I can tell you that. So Renegade was by no means anywhere near it. I mean, I did Power Rangers, and, when they first said, it's about a girl named Rita who lives on the moon, I said, well, can I give my son the credit? So Josh Robinson appears on the first season of that show. So, you really have to go in and try to, find the gems in any show. I mean, every show has a little bit of a gem, although some of the reality shows nowadays, maybe not, but you never can say, this is a piece of dog do and I'm just going to keep it that way. You really have to work and try to make it the best you can.
Yeah, for the record, I did watch Renegade. I was amused by it and entertained a little bit because I was a martial arts geek too, so.
Yeah, so it has that aspect, silliness, but, martial arts are kind of cool.
So
sort of like Kwai Chang Kang in the new era,
Yeah.
roaming around lone guy on a motorcycle,
Help our listeners who are not aware of what an editor's job is to let us know exactly the kind of impact that your job has on a show, and particularly the difference of editing a show like Babylon 5 as opposed to something like Renegade.
Oh, well, editing is really, it really takes a lot of storytelling effort. That's basically what an editor, at least in the episodic realm, an editor really controls the pacing of the show and the story on whether you're going to build tension or whether it's going to be light or whether, which direction, what you're going to reveal or not reveal. On a show like Babylon 5, it was more science fiction, sort of mystery, sort of drama. And Renegade was, sort of a little bit detective and a little bit of comedy in it. So the directions are totally different. The pacing gets handled like if it's, Renegade, there were a lot of action scenes where you would have, hundreds of feet of film to choose from. So, Babylon 5, there were very few action scenes where you'd be rolling two and three cameras at the same time. So editing Renegade was a lot more intensive at times. Editing Babylon 5 was a lot more cerebral at times. The story in Babylon 5 was really in-depth. So you really, as an editor, you really had to keep aware of what was happening, when and where, in conjunction with the story arc, because the arc of the story was everything in that. You just couldn't, reveal something that you knew that was going to happen further down the line, maybe a year or two later. So it took a lot more thinking to edit Babylon 5, even though it was a slower-paced show. You really had to think about the character development and the story arc a lot more than you did on Renegade.
So did you have a deeper insight into what Straczynski was after in terms of the bigger picture than other members of cast and crew?
In a way, yes. Sometimes he would come in and he would let you know little things that were going to happen. Oh, well, we can't show that. We can't reveal that. A character can't act a certain way. They have to be, you know, in the case of Jakar, you know, stoic. You can't, you know, break him down and let him, you know, until the moment when he does have a moment where he does break down. And Londo, of course, you know, sort of, you know, the kind of jovial guy. Who really has a deeper side of him, and conflicts inside of his own mind. So, you really do have to get into each character and where they are in the world of Babylon 5. It's not just Ivanova and she's, you know, aboard the ship. It's Ivanova and her character, or the doctor and his character. I mean, everyone has a different aspect to their character that you really have to keep aware of.
One of the things that transpired on Babylon 5 is when Joe would deliver a script to us and the various departments would start to digest what was coming their way, we would have these production meetings, and we were always to include the editor that would ultimately work on that particular episode, so that they were there from the very pre-production phase to learn what was going to unfold, so that they were part of the integral part of the production, so that they knew what to expect and how to best translate it in post. Now, we had a team of, what did we have, Skip, about four or five editors, and you would rotate?
Total, we had, for each season, we had three editors. We had a total of four who worked on the show, but three editors per season that would rotate through 21 episodes.
And so the other thing... I'm sorry, Summer, but the other thing that was most interesting I'd like to ask you about is over the 5 years, I believe post-production was in at least three different locations. Were you guys actually in four different locations?
Oh, let me see. Yeah, we were in one, one being the Academy building, which was a nice building, and then we moved
right.
to Glendale for
right.
a short time, and then we moved back to being across from the Academy building. So three different locations over
three locations
years.
where the entire post-production facilities had to pack up and go move their stuff midstream and unpack for a little while, but don't get too comfortable, and then repack again and then move back again. And so give us just a little insight about how the entire post-production process worked.
Oh, well, as you said, it started with the pre-production meeting. We get a script a couple days before the pre-production, read it in peace, and then we'd have a pre-production meeting, and then people would pose different questions about the story or about what would be needed. Then filming would start, and the editor was one day behind the camera, meaning that we would always be editing one day after the camera. So we try to keep up with that schedule. We got 7 days usually to cut the show, and then one day to refine our cut. The directors would come in and make their changes on the cut. They usually got 1 or 2 days. Usually it was a one-day edit with the directors. By the way, we'd make a copy, of course, of our cut. Since we're editing on computers, you make a copy of the editor's cut. The director comes in, makes their changes. You make a copy of the director's cut. The producers come in and make their changes. After that, it goes off to the network, which in the later stages, the network had less and less to do with any of the cuts. They were just viewing them. Then it would go to what we call online, where they would actually take the physical tape and compile the show. Then color timing, which is adjusting all the colors so they... look pristine, and then audio finish, which was a huge part of the show, and that was it.
And that actually leads into the question I was going to ask, was how closely do you work with the directors and the writers when you realize that something has to be cut because of time?
There was a lot of cutting of time. Usually the timing really didn't get cut too much by the directors. Sometimes little scenes little phrases sometimes would come out. The editors would rarely cut a line or cut for time. They would just cut the script as it was. And then Joe would come in and he would say, okay, how long are we or how short are we? And then he would, in a matter of seconds, predetermine where he was going to cut or add. He would go to, okay, go to scene 49. Okay, mark in, mark out, and take that out. And usually it was pretty seamless. It was amazing how he could judge the timing of the content of a certain scene and be able to extract it and still have the story be fluid and make sense.
Were there any episodes, I guess really the question I want to ask is there a particular episode that stands out in your mind where you feel like the kinds of edits and cuts you made were, I guess what I'm saying is you made your cuts, they look and they go, oh, Skip, you hit it right on the nose.
when you're editing, it's everyone's effort. So it's really hard to hit anything right on the nose, especially with Babylon 5. I would have to say The Coming of Shadows probably has my strongest influence on. I think that was season 3. I'm not sure. But that show I really liked and really got into it and the story arc. But, you know, it has a lot to do with a lot of different things. The photography, to, you know, with John Flynn shot, the director who directed it, and, you know, what was the script all about. So, it you know, when you have a show, it has a lot of people's fingerprint on it. And, you know, it's really hard for an editor to take any sort of credit for, you know, saying, that show has my fingerprint on it, because it really takes an army to do a show. The editor, you know, puts it together and it controls the pacing and, you know, controls the story in certain aspects, but, you know, the script is the main thing. I mean, the script has to be there or else, you know, you're not really not working with anything, you know. Oh. It all starts with the script.
You should be very proud of that one, because that was season 2 and it won a Hugo. So you did a lot right in that episode.
Yeah. And for what
it's been a long time, it's hard to remember which year was which.
And for what it's worth, we talked with Walter Koenig last week, and when asked about some of his favorite moments as Bester on the show, one that he brought up was the 4th season episode where he's in a transport tube with Garibaldi and telling Garibaldi what he's done to his brain and reprogramming him, and mentioned that it was a very intense scene, especially at the final product with tight close-ups and the way it was edited, and he made a special remark about how well it was directed and edited and put together. So I thought I'd pass that on to you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it also has to do with the music also. Where the music stings is so important. The music in that show and the music in any show, any episodic, is really, really important. It's something that people really don't think of, because you really shouldn't notice the music when you're watching a show. It's, you know, you take it out and you'll notice it, or if it's bad, you'll notice it. But when it's good, you really don't notice the music. It's something it's a really strange thing that happens. And, you know, I have to give it to Christopher Franke for, you know, scoring such beautiful stuff, even though he did it in Germany. But
now, Babylon 5 was the first television show to make extensive use of CG special effects. You also mentioned that the show was edited digitally as well. Was that a first?
No, that was not a first, but we used some of the first things. Like, we were the first ones to use joint drives. We call them Unity now, and I don't remember what we called them before that, but we all worked off of the same set of drives, so we all had access to the same footage. That way we had stock shots, like the external of the space stations. We'd create new ones, but we had a lot that we would use again over the course of 5 years. So that was a first. But no, the Avid was around for about 4 or 5 years before that. But we did take it to its fullest extent. I got to say that. I mean, we had all 3 Avids working all the time.
Was it a particular challenge working with the CG?
the challenge of working with the CG was not really having the CG to look at or to visualize as you're editing. There were a lot of times when there were the CG shots were being created, or and we had to just imagine what it would be and try to time out in our minds what the shot would look like. And you know, you'd walk by an editor's bay, and you know, they'd be making a sound effect in there, and you know, to simulate what the Star Fury would look like going across the screen, so they could time out the action. And then you would put in a slug that would say, you know, scene 43, Star Fury crosses frame from left to right, and then you know, guys in CGI, guys and girls in CGI would do it. So it was it really took a lot of imagination as far as that, the CG goes. An exterior establisher. How long am I going to lead that up, and how long am I going to swing? How much of the audio from the incoming scene am I going to put under the station to bring us into the station to keep everything flowing? So that's where your imagination and the CGI, you know, really went to the furthest extent. And you know, you really just had to imagine what it would look like. And fortunately, the CGI, I got to tell you, the first time I saw the CGI, though, I was really, really blown away. I mean, I was blown away. It looked and like it was a real station. And I thought, well, you know, 10 years before this, you would really have a hard time convincing somebody that it wasn't real. It just looked so clean. The shadows as they, you know, as the station rolled and, you know, made its rotations, the way the shadows came across and the lighting and the stars, and oh, I was just blown away, just blown away.
Skip, we were also the, I think, among the very first shows shot in a 16:9 format. While not true high def, we at least were allowing for that. Did that cause issues, concerns at that time? That was early on in that process.
It was very early on in that process, and a lot of times it did, you know, where is the framing actually going to be? How much of the set are we actually going to see? Yes, it did cause a few problems in the early stages, but once we got used to it, it seemed to, you know, work out well. I mean, that more had to do with, you know, John Flynn and the way he framed things. But yes, you know, on our Avid, we could see the whole frame at times, so it was nice, and we could see that. I just wish it had been able to go to the homes that way. But you know, yeah, when you're ahead of your time, you know, it's just kind of, you know, just, you know, people at home missed it. But it would, you know, at times it looked like a movie, you know, more than a TV series. Because of the framing, because of 16:9. And well, it's one of those shows that, you know, you see the news, you know, and they say a high definition 16:9. Well, you know, I don't understand why you would want to see the news that way, but, you know, a series like Babylon 5, which is, if you really think about it, it's half of a movie. It's a 1-hour show, so it kind of lends itself to that format, to being widescreen and being surreal and being like a movie and not like a television show.
Skip, you were also editor for Crusade.
Yes, I was.
Was when that show kicked off, was that seen from a production standpoint, from where you were, was that seen as a continuation of Babylon 5, or did you use that as a point where you took stock of what you had done on B5 and said, okay, let's rethink what we're doing, or and build on what we've done, or made changes, or so forth?
Well, it was definitely a continuation, but the style was slightly different. It was slightly darker in tone-wise, and it was edited that way. I actually really liked the show Crusade, and the movie that kicked it off, Call to Arms, which was really surreal to me. And being in different realities. But yes, it was a continuation, and you know, we kind of used the same methods in a way, as far as the CGI and editing style, but it was darker. It was a darker show. and so it was a little bit of a jumping off point, but definitely a continuation.
So do you have any favorite episodes or favorite moments where you saw the episode coming together and you just knew that you hit it?
I can say on Call to Arms, there's one moment. I'm going into my memory is going back now, so it's in Call to Arms when I thought of Bruce Boxleitner waking up on the cliff, and he's in another world, and we triple cut it where he's getting up, and then he's back down again, and he gets up again. And you go to a wider shot, and it gets up again. And I thought, wow, that's really surreal. And I thought, wow, that kind of hit that one on the head.
So my last question for Skip, this is my last question, is, you had talked about the teamwork, Skip. I want to know if at any point in your Babylon 5 career you were able to actually hit a home run for the softball team.
My daughter is a softball player in my family. I cannot hit a ball if my life depended upon it. And I've seen my daughter slam them. I mean, just absolutely slam a ball. But my son also, I mean, I've seen him kiss Mr. Spalding goodbye and just hit it out park. But for me, I can't hit a ball if my life depended upon it. My sports don't really go in that realm. I'm more of a, I like lacrosse and I like, soccer and I like those kind of sports. But softball, I'm from back east, so we didn't play too much softball, unfortunately. Yeah, in the neighborhood I grew up in. Kind of weird, but I can pass down to my daughter and my son.
So what are you currently working on?
Currently, I am we just finished up an HBO first look for DreamWorks Over the Hedge. And right now I'm working on a DVD special feature for the movie Ice Age 2.
Oh.
It just keeps on going for me. A couple of weeks ago, I was working on special features for the movie Forbidden Planet, which is going to be re-released.
Ooh, can't wait for that one.
Really?
It's actually going to be really cool. It's really going to be cool. And then, if you haven't seen Forbidden Planet in a long time, it's really, I mean, there are so many things that, you can tell were taken from that movie. And I think that's where probably all science fiction really, really got started. It was great to see it again.
Yeah, in terms of cinema and television, I mean, there's almost a direct line running between it and Star Trek.
Oh yes, exactly. All right, and Star Wars, I would think.
Right. With Robbie the Robot, sure.
I mean, there's a remember Zathras in the machine.
Oh right, yes. Oh yeah, the whole
right. There's a scene.
That's almost like the Crow machine there.
All right, and there's a machine. There's a scene where they go down into the planet, Forbidden Planet. That's kind of what it reminded me of. It's amazing. Yeah,
And now I'm thinking of the scene with the force field, where they've got the force field. The first nightfall after they know the id monsters out there.
Right. Huh.
And all of a sudden, this thing starts straining. You never see the creature itself; just the outline as it's hitting the outline
and the laser fire.
Right. Oh, yeah. And then you can see that in the shadows.
Incredible movie. And to think it was done in 1955 is really mind blowing.
Right.
Because
fantastic.
We watched it in my editing bay on the big screen in here, and I tell you, 1955 and the rich color and the effects, and even the weird music. It's really really good. I can't really wait to see it again on the really big screen. I actually see it for the first time on the really big screen. I only saw it on my 16:9 monitor in the edit bay, but I heard it's going to be re-released again.
Theatrically?
Theatrically, over at the Egyptian for a couple nights. So
wow,
Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. That's what I heard. So don't quote me on that, but that's what I've heard going around. That it's I haven't had a chance to check the internet on that yet. They keep me pretty busy over there.
Skip, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Okay, Jeffrey.
Yes, thank you very much.
We greatly appreciate your input. These stories are always terrific.
Oh, great, great. And happy to join you guys, all right?
Well, wonderful. Thank you for your time.
Okay, guys. So long.
From the worlds between the pages of your favorite book to adventures teetering on the edge of the dice, welcome aboard the Dragonhearth.
You got to get that landing thing fixed. I start every new time period looking like I fell out of a barrel. Where are we?
We are about to die. Salute you!
Uh-oh. That can't be good.
We're in a gladiator cell?
Come away from the barred window. This might be a good time for us to go over the basic rules from the Time Traveler's Field Guide.
Not again.
Join our next voyage through your favorite RSS server or by visiting us at DragonHearthProductions.com. Tracy and Laurie Hickman's Dragonhearth. Voyages into the realms of imagination.
Okay, we're back, and speaking of post-production and all that other goodies that go on behind the scenes, we have a bit of interesting news. Let's see if I can... How do we word this? Warner Brother and BitTorrent have joined forces to make available lots and lots of Warner Brothers content that you can download pay to download through BitTorrent.
Very interesting. And of course, the question that it's on everybody's mind who's listening right now is Babylon 5 on that list?
Yes, Babylon 5 is on that list. Otherwise, I wouldn't be mentioning it here.
Well, a couple things come to mind at that point. Number one, will all this be available? Will all 5 years be available simultaneously, as opposed to the AOL TV program, where apparently it's only selected groups of episodes at any given time, and then of course how that might impact that AOL deal.
If anything, it's just going to make more and more software available. What I'm reading here on both the Slice of Sci-Fi website and at the San Francisco Chronicles website is that at least 200 different Warner Brothers properties, from Harry Potter to The Matrix to Corpse Bride to older movies like Dog Day Afternoon and Vacation, are going to be available, and Babylon 5 is one of those that's going to be available. What I'm reading here is that newer movies will be available for the same price as a DVD, whereas TV shows such as Babylon 5 will cost about a dollar or more. And with Fox jumping onto iTunes with 24 and Prison Break, and both CBS and ABC putting their stuff on their own websites, I think they're finally embracing the dragon.
Right, exactly. Now, that's interesting. Not having had any experience with BitTorrent, I don't know what the quality of these downloads are going to be. Is it going to be, DVD quality that you would comparable to what you're buying at Best Buy?
I don't see why it couldn't be, because with BitTorrent, you're not limited in quality or bandwidth. You have a, shall we say, a 700 meg file. It, because of the way BitTorrent works, it breaks that file up and it splits the work, so to speak, mm-hmm. between multiple servers. So you might be downloading a file from anywhere from 2 to 200 different peers. The number of other peers also feeding you that file determines on how fast you download it. So size is not an issue. That's one of the good things about BitTorrent. You aren't choking off one source point by having, 100 people download, a half gig file.
Gotcha. Well, this could be good news for B5 fans, especially those who haven't been particularly well-heeled to spring for the DVD set.
Mm-hmm. And I think it actually opens up getting Babylon 5 online to people who can't use AOL, like people in other countries, and those of us who don't use Windows.
Exactly. I don't do Windows. Now, the other question that I would have is, do you get commentary tracks with these?
Mm.
You know, if they're already pre-existing, I'm not saying that you're suggesting that there's going to be commentary tracks on every single episode. But, you know, in essence, will they be taking the content that's currently available on the DVD and setting that for being downloaded through BitTorrent? Or are they just saying, you know, here's the episodes and that's what you get?
It might be just the episodes, just like on AOL. I don't think the AOL downloads have the alternate audio tracks either.
Right.
Although I'd like to hear from our listeners if that's true or not. I mean, I don't know how you do alternate audio buried in like a QuickTime file or something else, but I don't think it's impossible.
Well, maybe what ends up happening is you're downloading two separate episodes at that point. You get the one with the commentary. Actually, you know what they do? Do it the way Ronald Moore does with Battlestar Galactica, with his commentary podcast.
Make the audio separate.
Right.
That might be possible. And
that would go for, you know, 50 cents or, you know, if the dollar is the entry point, leave it at a dollar. It seems to be, mm-hmm. you know, iTunes selling songs for 99 cents. And why not? At that point, you know, you've spent $2, but you've got Joe Straczynski's commentary that you're listening to on your iPod while you're watching Fall of Night.
Huh. That could be interesting.
Not a bad idea.
It says that they're going to begin making these shows available this coming summer. And this is, once again, this is a legal deal between Warner Brothers and BitTorrent. Part of BitTorrent's deal over the past, I guess, 6 months to a year has been trying to weed out as much pirated software, pirated content as possible. Yeah. And basically making nice with the MPAA. So
right.
Warner Brothers content will be the first available via BitTorrent legally that I can see. And it could help, because I could see this going places. Like, say Warner Brothers has a movie in the can. They don't want to spend $20 million in marketing for it because they know it's a dog. It's not going to do jack at the box office. But hey, somebody out there wants to watch it. Let's put it on BitTorrent for $5 and see what we get back.
Well, Summer, you're such a sourpuss. Let's take it at a different. Let's look at it a different way.
Okay.
Warner's got a quirky, odd little show that's about a space station and sort of United Nations in space, and they know that they can't really make it run on traditional network television because they know the audience isn't going to be there. So let's put it up on through the BitTorrent feed.
Hmm.
Like any technology, it's going to be used for good or ill. You know, yeah, you're right. There are going to be some dogs that they've got out there. We've already invested the money in it. We know we can get at least back production costs if we put it up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we can spin all kinds of conspiracy theories at that point. You can have a whole viral marketing thing about, you know, got it so bad. How bad can it be? Well, we got to download it to see if it's the worst movie ever made. But on the other hand, no, at that point, you know, you can really start targeting your demographic. You can go out there and say, you know what, judging by who's downloading what, and, you know, not necessarily by names, but, you know, okay, Babylon 5 is getting X amounts of downloads. We know we've got that audience, all right? So we've got this property in here. We, you know, with the advances in CG, we can make it look pretty good. It doesn't have to play on high-def TV necessarily, you know, because yeah, you know, some people are going to want to watch on their big screen, but you know what? You say,
we're making this for you to view on your video iPod. We're making this to view on your 20-inch monitor at work or whatever, your laptop when you're flying coast to coast. So we're not having to spend on the kinds of things you need to spend on to make a high-def production look that great. Right. It's going to look good. We'll focus on the stories, and, you know, everybody's happy.
Yeah, and one of the things that mentioned in one of the other articles I read was that you will not be able to burn the content you purchase via BitTorrent to DVD, but you can keep it on your computer as long as you want, watch it as many times as you want. You just can't save it to DVD. That's what they say.
Well, then I guess the high def. Well, I know somebody's going to already figure out a way to hook their high def TV up to their laptop, I'm sure. But
dude, well, some of the monitors out there are better than most TV sets out there.
No, I drool every time I go to the Apple Store and look at the 30-inch cinema display.
What are you talking about? I'm going to put a mini Mac on my TV sometime this year. No kidding.
Yeah.
That's no kidding. Just had to throw that in there. Sorry.
Well, okay. But that's that. At that point, you know, the storage medium isn't, you know, 5 1/4-inch plastic discs. It becomes hard drives.
Yeah.
You know, and you start going through a flash memory. If it gets to that point, you know, okay, I'm gonna go through my collection of data crystals. Let's see. I'd like to see.
There you go. Yeah, so this will be kind of interesting to see how it works out, and who knows, maybe this could be an alternate, maybe this could be a way for them to figure out what projects that might not be get to go to DVD, because we were talking before about, you know, TV series going direct to DVD because people would buy them. This way people could get a peek at them first and say, yeah, I'd buy that on DVD, and then go buy them.
Right, or conversely, you can put out stuff that you know people, you know, I'd be willing to shell out a dollar for, you know, episodes of you know, whatever, but I'm not going to buy DVDs. Okay, you're still making some money. You know,
careful, Tim. Careful, Tim. You're getting dangerously close to, I'd buy that for a dollar.
Oh.
No, I mean, I'm thinking, I don't know if either of you remember a series on NBC called Quark.
Oh, yeah. Loved that show.
Loved it, too, but where is it? Okay, well, if somebody makes it available for a dollar on iTunes or whatever, I'd buy that for a dollar.
There you go.
Speaking of shows that aren't available, you know, Max Headroom and Brimstone. I'd buy those DVD sets in a heartbeat, but they're not there.
Right. Mm. Exactly. Well, I mean, we could be seeing the sea change at this point. You know, it could be, like you say, Summer, they found a way to embrace the dragon and make it work for them. And, yeah.
I like that embrace the dragon reference. Let's keep using that. and I do have to throw a plug in here. You know, that was found on Slice of Sci-Fi website.
Yes, so it was.
If you're not reading Slice of Sci-Fi website, you are missing out on a lot of sci-fi news. Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Michael, for that.
Talented
Hey, I have an agenda too, so.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, that's our B5 news for this week. Let's take a quick break and jump back into user feedback, listener feedback.
My lord, the war goes well. But rebel propaganda is convincing more and more systems to join the Alliance. If this continues, we could have a problem.
I believe it is time to unleash the Emperor's secret weapon. Communications officer.
Comms are open, my lord.
Command to TD-0013.
Meanwhile, on Tatooine!
I'm telling you, babe. If you got a can opener, I got the time. Trust me. Once you pop the top, you can't stop.
Command to TD-0013. Your Empire needs you.
God damn it! What now?
A different point of view. The Star Wars saga through the eyes of a stormtrooper. For all things TD-0013, go to www.adpov.net. Don't be fooled by imitations and clones. This is the only point of view you need.
right, it's listener feedback time. Yay!
Hey, we have listeners and feedback.
We have listeners, and they're talking to us. This is the best part of it. They're actually telling us what they think, how they feel, and this little interaction is how we get better, give them a better product. They give us ideas. We go, oh, yeah, we forgot about that. And we just, you know, we keep making them happier. They keep making us better. I like that.
Yeah, it's like one big happy family.
Greetings, all. This is Michael Johnston. We just listened to the podcast with Scott Devine, and he said that he didn't have access or couldn't get the trailers. I wonder, the trailers on the DVD are about 3 minutes long. The trailers that I have for all 5 years are about 6 minutes long. What was the difference? Did you get a feeling that they're just not available? The music that goes with the trailers that you get down from downloading them obviously is copyrighted, but was that the holdup? What was the reason that the longer trailers weren't done? I didn't quite understand that. It may have been copyright, but I don't think it was cost, and I don't think it was that he couldn't find them. It also could be quality. The quality is certainly not up to standard. Anyway, I too am like you. I'd love to hear Christopher come on. It's time for him to get on the podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much. Michael signing off.
Wow.
Yeah. Michael, bring
well,
it on.
Take that, Scott.
Yeah, right. And Christopher.
Yeah, because I don't know why they couldn't find all of the trailers. They might have just lost them, because the only ones I have were that, you know, all of season 3, a couple from season 2, none from season 1, that you could have downloaded from, I think it was Warner Brothers Babylon 5 website.
Well, the other thing that I'm curious about, you know, and I'm not necessarily, you know, questioning Michael's good character, but it seems to me a 6-minute trailer for an upcoming episode is awfully long, especially, you know, even, you know, 10, 12 years ago, they were cutting time on television shows for commercials, and to give up 6 minutes of time that could be used, you know, not only for ads, but maybe even a little bit of story, that seems kind of odd to me.
Hmm. Yeah, I have to admit that when he said 6 minutes, my eyebrows went up and said, really? You know, I don't have any insight, so maybe this will wind up being a running dialogue with Scott and only just serve to piss him off that he didn't know about this when he was producing them. But the promos, to my recollection, weren't done by the production company. They were all done by the promo people at Warner Brothers, which was so far removed from the production. So I got nothing for you, Michael, but thanks for bringing it to our attention.
Yep. All right, roll the next one.
Hey, gang. This is John from Houston, and I just thought I'd throw a couple of questions at you. One, of all the 5 seasons, which of the beginning introductions did you like the best? And two, just like to get y'all's comment, maybe to talk about the spiritual aspect of the show, because like in Star Trek, it always seems to take this anti-religion stance as opposed to Babylon 5, which each race is and spiritual beliefs played a huge role in the show. Thanks, enjoy, keep up the great work. Bye.
Well, let's tackle the easy question first. Summer, what was your favorite opening?
I must admit to being conflicted. Musically, I think the 3rd season is my favorite intro, but from a visual collage, I like the 5th season. The way that all that just blends in and shows you just so much more of the B5 universe. I like what that did. But musically, 3rd season.
Jeffrey, how about you?
Well, I think I agree with Summer. You know, the 5th season seemed to be, and maybe that's because by that time we were all very connected to the story. And so to see all those elements flash before us, really helped draw you in to start this. I don't know. So yeah, maybe there was just familiarity that helped us connect that. But if I'm not mistaken, and maybe I am because this is a long time ago now, was the fifth season, was it the one where the camera finally tracks all the way down this 5-mile space station and gets around the ass end of it, and we see Joe's name on the ass end of the ship? Is that true?
Yes. Those darn That's taggers, true. I believe, is what he said.
Exactly. And so that was the great gag. And the truth was that the visual effects guys had never had to model the back end of the ship, so we never really saw it and didn't need to see it. And so that's why it was sort of a gag that we finally paid off. And at the end, it turned out it was Joe's name on the back of the ship.
Well, I also like the little play in, what's the episode, The Korra's Mother, The Korra's Father. You get this big Psycor logo in the back.
Yes, I agree. I like the fifth season one for reasons like you said, Jeffrey, that we're so connected to the story. It's very much just seeing it all unfold. But for me, musically, that's also the best one because I think that Christopher Franke's theme for that captures the entire essence of the show. In other words, it's at once triumphant. You know, Straczynski and crew have accomplished the almost impossible task of telling the 5-year arc. At the same time, there's a bittersweet element knowing that this is truly the end. There's just the swells of victory and also the tragedy as well. All comes through in that one bit of music. It's just amazing.
I think John asked some really good questions here. You know, on the religious front, I don't think it's any big secret that Joe has had very clear, shall we say, religious beliefs. And I have always wanted to applaud Joe for the fact that he challenged the belief systems, several belief systems throughout the story arc, and would raise important questions, and they were probably the questions that Joe was challenging inside his own mind.
Mm-hmm. I
agree with that, and I think what's also very interesting is there's the one scene in the fourth year, and I can't remember the exact title of the episode. It's the one where the Baptist ministers come on board, and I think it's the episode after The Rock cried out. And I can't remember the title, but there's a scene between the preacher and Sheridan where, the preacher kind of knows that Sheridan's nervous about the upcoming war, that they're about to launch against Earth. And the minister kind of goes to comfort him. And at one point, as the minister is about to say something, Sheridan says to him, "Now you're about to tell me I need to turn all over and believe in God and everything will be fine." And the minister goes, "No, I'm not going to tell you that at all, because that's not what I'm here for. What I'm here to tell you is there is somebody who believes in you," and he's making reference to Dylan at that point. And I thought that was just the most marvelous, open-minded, religious character I'd seen on television in such a long time. You know, he was in essence a minor, character when all said and done, but that one line of dialogue just gave him amazing depth, and I think that shows the kind of writer that JMS was to handle such sensitive topics as spirituality. You know, and as far as Star Trek goes, you have to remember when Star Trek first premiered, the original Star Trek is 1966, and it wasn't necessarily being anti-religion. I think Roddenberry was very much a humanist. You know, his whole point wasn't to deny spirituality. He was just basically saying that as mankind grows up and reaches out to the stars, we can find it within ourselves. I think that over time, as we've seen with the Star Trek franchise, that philosophy has become ossified into... It's more policy now, and so it does become more anti-religion. That's just my feeling on that. So,
you go, girl.
I'm not really here to bash Star Trek. Honest to God, I'm a fan too, but they make it easy for themselves at this point in time.
Yeah, I just liked that it they added a bit of depth to all the characters. You know, not everybody danced around the subject all the time. It was actually an integral part of some of the races, and that was refreshing to see. You saw them interacting based on different sets of beliefs, more than just, you know, trade and commerce and war.
So is there another one?
Yes, there is.
Hi, I'm trying to get a hold of the Babylon Podcast Show. This is the number that you had listed on your website. My name is Brian Steele. I'm one of the Mongoose Publishing writers that do a lot of work for the Babylon 5 license. I just listened to my boss do his podcast, and I got a kick out of it. And I just wanted to say that I think what you guys are doing is awesome. And from someone who's trying to put a little life back in the license, that I'm glad that you guys are doing what you're doing, and you should keep on going. So from all of us that actually do enjoy the license still and are trying to spread the love, I'm glad that you guys are doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much, Brian.
Yes, and perhaps we will give him a call, get his views on what he's been doing with Mongoose.
Yeah, we'll find out when his book is coming up and get him on the show.
There we go. A little bit of love. All right, I've got a couple emails here.
Sweet.
Let's kind of run through those. This one I'll do fairly quickly here. This is from Andy Hummel. And Andy is going to get the last dig in on the question of how Kosh could have been poisoned. He says, my answer to this has always been that the shadows would have been quite familiar with Vorlon physiology and might have been able to create a substance that reacts with an energy being by draining or transforming the energy being's energy or life force. If the shadows could have pulled off such a scheme that would get the Vorlons ticked off with humans and possibly Mambari too, the shadows would have advanced their cause quite a bit. I've always suspected them of sowing the seeds of the split between the Mambari cast later in the series, so if they had been agents working on the Mambari warrior cast and pushing the right buttons, they could accomplish quite a lot. Okay, it's as far as I'm concerned, as logical as anything else, and the fact is that it's one of those plot threads that kind of evaporated at the end of the first season. So I haven't heard the one theory that wraps it all up nice and neatly that makes me sit back and go, wow, that's it. So...
yeah, I do. Even though it's implausible, I do like the idea that maybe someone behind the scenes had sowed the seeds of dissension between the warrior caste and the religious caste, but we kind of already know that the Earth Mambari War did that.
Right, exactly.
I just love all of the, you know, this is so reminiscent of so many situations throughout the arc that leave these wonderful little gaps that allow the opportunity for fan fiction to start to unfold.
Right. Well, and you know, the fact is that we can sit here and geek out about it. Just makes it all the more wonderful.
Because what else would you do, Tim?
Well, I can't really say that on the air. So, yeah. With that, let's go to the next email. Yeah, Michael. Michael Tiernan says, could you ask Jeffrey to spend a minute discussing his craft side of things? What did he have to do as the Vorlon clothes rack that none of us would have known? What acting was involved? I know that it's not just a job any schmo can walk into and do, so there's got to be something in it that we, the fans and viewers, don't see, and I'm really curious about what it is.
Yes.
It's too late for the pebbles to vote.
Yeah, that's the core of the show. I think we covered that stuff. Didn't we get into that?
Yeah, we covered
get
that.
Get drunk at the studio one day and get into all that sort of stuff?
Yes, your little, shall we say, enlightened by alcohol discussion.
Yeah, it was either that one or it was one. Yeah, it was one of the ones, but one of the earlier episodes we did. I think I got into most of those things, and you know, I don't know. It was come on,
so Michael. Go to the Babylon Podcast website and start scrolling down and look through the archives. You'll find, I think it was episode 6. I want to say.
Mm-hmm. And we also did a little bit of detail episodes. Episode 1, I believe.
Right. We did so.
Okay.
Just another day of wearing fiberglass, Michael. That's all you need to know.
Is that it for our emails?
One last one, and I'm going to edit this one a little bit for a variety of reasons, not the least of it's kind of lengthy. So Mike Zablinski, I'm sure I mangled that. I apologize, Mike. Says, let's just take it for granted that I've told you that I love the podcast. Though B5 left me rather cold when it first came on, I've really come around and consider myself a fan of the show now. One day I'll even buy the DVDs, but not until I have more disposable income or find them cheap at a yard sale or online. Keep up the good work. If you continue to be as good as you have been, I will have to stop burning CDs at work and actually buy an MP3 player, which would be money well spent to keep up with your excellent show. Thank you.
Okay, he can stay. We like him. He's on the Christmas list.
Very much so.
And don't forget those online episodes you can check out over at AOL's Into TV.
Exactly.
Well, are we done?
Another fine episode.
No more emails?
Awesome. Nope, no more emails.
All right. That will conclude our show for today. If you want to send us an email, that address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach us by leaving us a voicemail. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the gate.